Welcome to Scholar's Circle, scholarscircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. History books usually designate California as a free state, in contrast to the slave states in the United States. Indeed, its entry into the U.S. was based so much on the principle that it was a free state that it led to the so-called Compromise of 1850. But historically, has California actually been a free state? Because we know the state has seen the practice of slavery, some of the first European presence to even potentially contemporary issues such as prison labor and instances of human trafficking. On today's show, we will explore the status of California historically as a free state and whether that's accurate. Our guest is Jean Falzer, and she's the author of a new book, California, a Slave State. She's professor of American Studies at the University of Delaware. Her other works include Driven Out, The Forgotten War Against Chinese Americans, Rebecca Harding Davis, Origins of Social Realism, and the Utopian Novel in America. Professor Falzer, Jean, if I may, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for joining us. And again, when we think of California, we usually designate California as a free state. Your book argues otherwise. How was California a slave state?
California has always been a slave state. It was born as a slave state, and it continues to be a slave state now. For 250 years, it was that slavery provided the labor force for California. It was an image of the control of a series of foreign empires that turned California sequentially into a colony. And within the control of California as a labor force was the control of the women and the children, their working and sexual bodies. Every definition of traditional slavery holds for California. And then there were ways that California evolved a series of unique forms, species of slavery. Frederick Douglass says that slavery is a many-headed hydra, and you cut off one head and two others grow in its place. And to me, that's the image of the evolution and the growth and definition of California as a slave state.
Yeah. Now, when you think of slave state, we tend to put this in the context of race-based slavery, African-Americans being enslaved in the United States. But California's history with slavery is actually quite multifaceted, isn't it?
It's multifaceted, and it's also almost always, not 100%, but it is almost always defined and shaped by race, by the multiracial nature of California. So it involved African Americans who were marched across the plains for the gold rush by plantation owners. It involved Native Californians, Native American Californians. It involved Chinese girls who were kidnapped from the ports of Guangdong, Canton in China. It involved Alaska Natives who were the first slaves transported into California for the otter trade. So that's where the environment meets slavery in California. And then it follows through into more modern times with the birth of the carceral state, with Indian boarding schools, and ultimately up to, sadly, the present day of human trafficking. But I do want to add, right at the beginning of our conversation, the thread that every single group of people who were enslaved in California revolted. Had we put a subtitle on this book, it would be The History of Slavery and Slave Revolts in California.
So then, actually, let's get into this question of revolt. There was a consistent slave revolt. And of course, in American history, the debates about whether slaves revolted, did they accept their position on plantations in the South? I mean, it tends to be a pretty intense and important argument. How important is resistance and revolt? And I guess the first question, defining that what California had was in fact slavery, and then telling the narrative about slavery as a narrative of domination and resistance rather than kind of a static institution where people were just compelled to labor?
Those are two questions. Maybe we'll separate them. In terms of defining California as a slave state and defining the commonalities and then some particular differences that shaped slavery in California, it always involved violence. It involved the ownership of people's labor and people's bodies. It involved working without wages. It involved not having the right to choose who you work for. Now, none of us totally have the right to choose who we work for, but you did not get to choose who you work for. And more important, you couldn't leave. You couldn't quit. And you worked, as I said, without any wages. It meant that also that in the ownership of your laboring body, slavery in California involved, as it did in the South, the ownership of one's reproductive and sexual body. So it ran through. If chattel slavery involves the buying and selling of enslaved people, in many of the instances in California, human beings were bought and sold, or their papers that marked them as enslaved people were bought and sold. So sadly, it checks all of the boxes of what one would typically define as slavery in California.
So then the question about revolt and the role that revolt plays, because I guess part of the issue of slavery is the description of slavery is pretty common in history books, but this question of resistance, you get these pockets of resistance. You think of Nat Turner's, you know, Rebellion, and then John Brown and Harper's Ferry. But it seems as though the narrative of slavery certainly presents an image of a slave who either was overwhelmed into submission or accepted his or her lot into submission. But your book really describes it as, you know, far from acceptance and quite a bit more rebellion.
There wasn't one instance of slavery in California where there were not slave revolts and slave resistance. And they weren't individual pockets of resistance. I'm speaking of mass slave revolts. If we start with the missions, where the notion, the Franciscan missions, 1769, Spain invades California. It enters with about 100 soldiers. Some of them had families or concubines or aides with them, but pretty much it's 100 soldiers and only 8 priests, topped by Father Junipero Serra. And with this small invasive force, Spain hoped to convert 310,000 Native Americans to Catholicism. Spain is traveling with a papal bull that facilitates this. And Spain wants to stop Russia that's moving down from the north, from Alaska. They didn't really envision what we now think of as settler colonialism, where people are going to move into a territory to only seize the land by living on it. So what happens in San Diego, right at the border, where we think of now Tecate and Tijuana, and we also now think this is where there are a lot of immigration detention centers are springing up. It's right there that slavery begins in California. And the first mission in California enslaves the Kumeyaay people, and one clan of the Kumeyaay people are the Ipai people. And within a year of building the mission San Diego, San Diego de Acala, the Kumeyaay people, in an organized mass revolt, clans from who lived near the beach in San Diego, clans who lived in the mountains, sweep down on Mission San Diego, burn the mission, slaughter the head priest, and free all of their people, the Kumeyaay, never to return. So this wasn't an individual who is feeling, I cannot endure this anymore, and I'm going to risk leaving my family, my familiar land, and flee north through Rochester up to Canada. This is an organized, militant, planned resistance, and it's of people who didn't have the horse. They didn't have the gun, and they didn't have the horse, and they free their people without those kinds of weaponry. So it begins right away.
And what you're talking about now is this, again, this narrative about the Spanish and indigenous peoples, the tribes in California. Typically, when thinking of Spain's role in California, we tend to think of land theft as well as kind of a forced conversions, loss of culture, loss of language being central. Slavery is not told in this narrative, you know, as frequently. Why do you think that is, that this is, you know, even in narratives about atrocities against the indigenous peoples, slavery is not usually listed, or if it is, it's usually not central to that description?
While I'm really reluctant always to use, as a historian, to use the word waves of immigrant, waves of slavery, we need to think about a sequence of enslavement of indigenous people in California. And the first instance is the Spanish coming in. And yes, they want the land. They need the land to feed their military, to feed the missions, and hopefully, wrongly, to send food back across the border and south to Peru and to Mexico to feed the people who are enslaved and working in the silver mines. So it isn't that they didn't think of agriculture. There were many forms of slavery in California that don't involve agriculture. If we think of Southeast Asia, if we think of the plantation south, we identify slavery with unpaid field labor. It certainly is a part of it. It's a part of it now in Northern California, in the marijuana grows. There's unpaid field labor. And it starts, obviously, with the Indians, where there's a huge growing population of Spaniards who need to be fed. And they need to be fed in ways that weren't traditionally native ways of feeding. One of the ways that slavery operated in California was destroying indigenous ways of people feeding themselves, letting loose their cattle on the seed fields. The native Californians didn't have the horse, and so their food practices were very local, and they planted seed fields, sat by the side of the field, waited for the animals to come to the seed field, and killed what they needed for food. As soon as the Spanish come, they let loose their horses and their cattle on Indian seed fields, and the cattle despoil the seed fields. They urinate, they defecate, they stamp on the seed fields, and that kills the Native American way of getting protein and of feeding their people. So it's a very unique kind of invasion of which food and survival are very linked.
You've made references to the church, and out here in California, there's a complicated relationship with the historical memory, remembrances, commemorations of the figure of Junipero Serra, that the church has tried to address some of these concerns. His figure is all over the state, is establishing all the different missions and questions about whether or not that should be removed. Your book goes into some of the details about the role that Junipero Serra, as the representative of the church in California, in some of these practices. Could you describe that for me?
From the very first, Junipero Serra really believes that he will be able to convert the native people of California, and that he sees the military not as the invading force, but the backup of his conversion. He was deranged, and he really thought that some of his religious practices would be tempting to Native people. Native Californians didn't have a history of rape. they didn't have a history of self-torture. The first mass that Junipero Serra holds in California is on the beach. It's by Pacific Beach. It's now it's surfers and restaurants with waiters on roller skates. This is where the first mass was held. And he holds up a huge gold cross. He has imported images of the Madonna and Child. And the priests who he has with him, their heads are hidden in these deep gray robes, almost like extended hoodies where people couldn't look out. And the native people look at these men in heavy gray robes and they think they're really going to be too hot to be happy in California. And why are they hiding from us? And are they some kind of weird army? And the golden cross that he holds up is fascinating, but it means nothing to the native people, to the Kumeyaay, the Ipai, who are gathered on the beach to watch this. Serra thinks they're waiting to be converted. And when they see him at a series of masses flagellate himself with iron hooks, they're just appalled. This is not an attractive religion to the Kumeyaay people. So the theology doesn't work. And what Serra understands, and his letters back to the Mother Church down in Laredo, Mexico, make it really clear that he is horrified and well aware that both the priests, although he doesn't like to talk about that, and the soldiers' rape of Native American women means conversion is going to be impossible. And he knows he needs to stop the rape. And rape is the theme of Junipero Serra's letters back to the Mother Church, saying, if we don't stop this, this whole deal will fall apart.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing a new book, California, a Slave State, with its author, Jean Falzer of the University of Delaware. I'm sorry, Jean, I cut you off with that as well. You were discussing Junipero Serra and the church's role in its initial presence in California. So,
the conversion doesn't hold. He builds 21 missions. The last two are to block the Russians even further to the north. So they're just to the north of San Francisco. The idea of conversion doesn't work. When Mexico wins its independence from Spain and takes charge of California and takes charge of the land, one of the plans is for Native people that they're going to be free. But many of their lands have been destroyed and they have no access to going home. And so it's a very complicated story of what is Native Americans' relationship with these dead missions that are now over. Can they remain there? Some of them know that it was their land, but others have been brought from far away to work at the missions. And going home is not an option. And many, many of them have died from syphilis, from cholera, from diseases, from starvation, malnutrition, assault. So there isn't this population of converted Catholics that's going to keep the tradition going. Talking about their resistance, the Native American resistance.
Yes.
Should we pick up on that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Every place that faced slavery in California, as I said, there was resistance. When the Russians bring in Alaska Natives in their beautiful, lightweight skin kayaks to kill the otter, where, as we said, this is where the environment meets empire, meets slavery. These Native Alaskans could kayak for 1,000 miles, and they take off, and they kayak up the many, many rivers that flow into the Pacific. When the Chinese merchants kidnap Chinese girls from China, to serve as prostitutes to this bachelor society in California, some of these girls flee if they can. Not very many, about 120, flee to the missions in San Francisco, the rescue missions, the shelters. Many of them resurface in the census and in the newspapers in rural Chinatowns throughout California. They have fled. San Quentin, where there is unpaid convict labor working in mills to support the new agriculture in California, San Quentin has the largest prison revolt, up there with Attica, of 1,000 convicts in San Quentin prison strike and have a revolt against working under brutal conditions with no pay, standing at looms for 12 hours a day when they're not allowed to speak. It's physically impossible to stand and not speak, not move for 12 hours and face a series of tortures if they do speak. And there is an enormous slave revolt, at what I call a slave revolt, of unpaid convict labor at San Quentin. And for the people who now face human trafficking, the human trafficking movement has helped organize survivors of human trafficking or people just trapped in human trafficking to flee. And throughout California, there are a series of shelters, and people are organizing the police to identify what kind of a tattoo, what kind of behavior, what kind of disease would mark either a field laborer or, in particularly, somebody who's been sexually trafficked and need rescue.
Now, one of the more complicated parts of whether California is a slave state or a free state, you're describing the history, you're describing practices. The law, however, seems to suggest, slavery is illegal. Or although you've uncovered kind of an interesting wrinkle to the question about whether or not from California's entry into the Union and throughout its history, was slavery actually illegal?
I think slavery has been legal or legalized in California from the get-go. The California Constitution, which was part of a trifecta for which California would enter the Union. One was California would enter the Union as a free state. The second is that other new states, in particular Utah and Nebraska, could choose whether or not they wanted to enter as free states, or this is the big compromise, right? Enter as free states or slave states. The third part that had long-term consequences was that the United States would pass the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. And with those three things in place, California bringing in $1.5 billion a year from gold could enter the United States as a state. The country really wanted that $1.5 billion to come in, and they shut its eyes to the new Constitution. What was in the new Constitution was a teeny, teeny bit of language, and it was much debated in Congress and debated for, I think, only 8 days at the state constitution. It says California will never tolerate slavery. Tolerate is not a legal standard. It's a good for go. And with that one word of never tolerate, California is allowed to presume to enter the country as a free state. The U.S. takes California from Mexico. We sign a treaty with Mexico. I may be getting a little bit into the weeds here, but we sign a treaty with Mexico, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo of 1848, by which we take almost the top half of Mexico. But we make a few agreements, and one is that Native Americans will keep their status as citizens that they had in Mexico. Native Mexicans Indian people, tribal people, were free citizens and valued as citizens in Mexico. We agree to that. We ditch that at the minute California starts its, writes its constitution. So right from the first, it's a wink, wink. There are 44 white people, 8 Latina people who write the California Convention. Of those 44 white men, most of them were slaveholders from Mississippi, from Missouri, who had come west, and some of them had come west with the intention of spreading slavery from the South to California. By 1850, by the time of the gold rush, slavery was a problem in the South. More money was invested in slaves in 1850 in the United States than was invested in land. It was very much in the interest of the South to expand slavery across the United States. And the vision of the New West was always meant to be as a way to expand slavery. We now know, historians know, how much slavery seeped into the Northern economy. When we think about all those mills up in New England, what were those girls milling? You know, when they were milling cotton, you don't grow cotton in New Hampshire. They were milling Southern cotton. When New York considers seceding from the Union at the front end of the Civil War, we don't think of New York as a Confederate state, but the entire prosperity of the port of Manhattan was bringing cotton from the South and transferring it up to New England. The port of New York depended on Southern slavery. So that web historians are now extending, that slavery wasn't just contained on the cotton fields. It's also important for us to remember that cotton and tobacco are really harsh on the land. And by the time of California coming into being, cotton and tobacco had really fouled and ruined the soil and the ecology and even the rivers of the South. And so it needed to expand as a profit-making industry. It needed to expand. We do remember, and of course, with Juneteenth this week, slavery is briefly very much in the public eye, that in 1808, the United States ends the global trade in slavery. That puts horrific pressure on the female slaves who remain in the South to become, quote, breeders, to produce the next generation of slaves. Plan B was to enslave other people or to expand slavery to other places. And that's where California fits in. It's an ecological issue, an economic issue, a human issue, a sexual issue that all come together in California.
When we return, we're going to talk about how this history extends into the 20th and 21st centuries and why the history of slavery in California plays such an essential role in understanding the state's economy, attitude about immigrant labor, and the state's general attitude about labor as a whole. So please stay tuned. Welcome back to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. California is usually seen as a free state. American history books suggest that it was a free state. It was admitted as a part of the Compromise of 1850 as a free state. Certainly not considered a part of the old Confederacy and generally considered to be a part of the pantheon of free states. But a new book called California, a Slave State, argues that actually slavery has long been the tradition, the history in California, Its author, Jean Falzer, has joined us. She's a professor of American Studies at the University of Delaware and the author of California, a Slave State. So, Jean, what happens to slave practices, the slave trade, actually less the trade, but the practices of slavery in California after the passage of the 13th Amendment? I presume that slavery ends in the state like it does across the rest of the Union.
You know, Doug, that question, what happens after the 13th Amendment, was part of what provoked me to write this book. I had a picture in front of me that I had actually held on to from my last book, Driven Out, The Forgotten War Against Chinese Americans. It's a picture of about a 14-year-old Chinese girl behind a caged brothel on Jackson Street in San Francisco. Slavery endures past the gold rush, past the immigration acts that are trying to ban Chinese people from coming into the country, and it thrives through enslaved prostitution of Chinese girls who are kept in caged brothels in Chinatown in San Francisco. So as I looked at that picture, the question that drove me to write this book was, what happened to the 13th Amendment? As I'm looking at this photograph from the early 1880s, the time of the Chinese Exclusion Act, the first American Immigration Act to ban a people by race. And yet there's this little girl. She looks like 12 or 14. Behind a cage. The other thing that impelled me to write this book was an article in a local paper of a 15-year-old girl who had been kept in a metal crate in the marijuana groves in Lake County in California. Lake County is a very remote, small county in Northern California. And this girl had been homeless and wandering the streets of Hollywood. And she gets picked up by two men who drive her the length of the state. They're growers in the marijuana trade, and they lock her in a metal box and they poke two holes in the box. And as we said, slavery is always violent. It always needs to be controlled. People do not volunteer or agree to their bondage. They poke two holes in the metal box. One is to hose her down, and the other is to prod her. And they would let her out to sexually service themselves and the other field workers in the marijuana grow, or to trim the buds from the marijuana bushes. Those two images of modern human slavery compelled me to start to look into what had happened, in particular to the 13th and 14th Amendment. And that took me into convict labor and, of course, Ferguson, Black Lives Matter, the presence of the carceral state, and modern prison labor took me very quickly beyond what I knew, beyond where I thought I was going, to really write the first history of San Quentin Prison. And in that history, I realized that was a link between unpaid convict labor that built the first streets of San Francisco, that built the sewage systems, that built mansions, the private mansions, where convicts were forced to work without pay to build the new cities of California. So we see it in convict labor. We see it in early stages of human trafficking, global human trafficking with the Chinese girls. And then we see it as we get into the 20th century with the Indian boarding schools. I didn't know that there were 12 Indian boarding schools in California, four very large ones. and at the Indian boarding schools, which was why parents who desperately wanted their kids to get an education would hide their children in the woods when recruiters came to seize their kids to send them to the Indian boarding schools. The Indian boarding schools, like Sherman in Riverside, California, in my view, were also plantations, slave plantations. They had programs that they called outing programs. Outing programs meant something quite different than it means to us now. The outing programs were systems where there were outing matrons, and they took these children and sent them, they sent the boys into the orange groves to work unpaid, uneducated, sleep in the groves, to pick oranges for the new Southern California agriculture. The girls were sent into the new hotels to work as domestic servants, to work as maids, all unpaid. And for the girls, they were very vulnerable, just to live one, two, or three in a household. They were extremely vulnerable to assault and abuse. And the boys were vulnerable to whipping, to hunger, and they were shipped all over the country. So we read now about Carlisle and the Native American school in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. The boarding schools in California are completely in touch with Carlisle, and they are copying the model, but they are intensifying the what was part of Carlisle. It's the core of the California Native American boarding schools was unpaid labor, and they had an elaborately designed outing program. So by the time we get to the now, there is a tradition of how to do human trafficking. One of the definitions of slavery is forced mobility. People are generally not enslaved where they are, where their families are, where they're born, because like the Kumeyaay, they'll be freed. And so people are transported to somewhere else. And that's a situation of labor trafficking now and sex trafficking in the now in California.
Now, I know you've written about the Chinese experience and the exclusionary acts, et cetera. And I was actually wrestling with this question because obviously there was this huge pushback, and California is the centerpiece of this, against Chinese immigration, Chinese labor, these exclusionary acts. And sometimes those get associated with the development of crime, of criminal syndicates and, you know, drugs and gambling, et cetera, in the so-called Chinatowns, you know, up and down the West Coast. So at one level, it would seem to suggest a pushback against Chinese labor. And that was always the justification for the Chinese Exclusionary Act, is because they're bringing so much crime with them. But you know, at one level, you're describing this to be somewhat accurate because there's human trafficking of young Chinese girls brought to these areas. And you said by Chinese merchants, I would imagine, to service these communities that are getting that pushback. So I guess the question is, the state of California responded to some of these enslavement, particularly the trafficking, by calling for Chinese exclusion. It doesn't sound like it was terribly successful. Was it actually counterproductive at trying to address issues of human trafficking?
There are a series of Chinese exclusion acts. The most famous one is the 1882 Exclusion Act, and that's the first act to ban a people by race. And that act makes it impossible for Chinese people to return from China or to enter the United States. Every 10 years, the Chinese Exclusion Act was re-upped. It had different names, but it was the Chinese Exclusion Act. But we need to spiral back a little bit. Chinese immigration to the United States is very unique because it was gendered. Chinese men chose to come here. They chose to come here the same reason that men from Chile and Argentina and Mexico and the East Coast and the Philippines chose to come here for the gold rush. And they came for the money, they came for the adventure, they came to get away. In the case of the Chinese, there'd been this crazy, massive utopian religious civil war where millions and millions of Chinese people died. We don't even have a number for how many Chinese people died in the Taiping Revolution, but the survivors migrate to the ports and to the city. And suddenly there's gold in California, and the Chinese men come and choose to come either for the gold rush or 15 years later to work on the Transcontinental Railroad. They sign contracts, they borrow money like my dad's family did to migrate, but they choose to come. And they represent well over 90% of the Chinese immigrants. It was such an unbalanced society of Chinese men with very, very few Chinese women. Chinese merchants' wives don't want to come with their merchant husbands. Part of it was Confucian notions of duty. Partly, they don't really like what they're hearing about what's going on in California. They have no impetus to go. So we're talking about a tiny percentage of the Chinese population who are, in fact, enslaved, and they are indeed diseased. They're suffering from sexually transmitted disease. They're suffering from cholera and all different kinds of dysentery in a state without decent sewage systems. But it's this tiny population that is marked as defining the Chinese population, as lewd, as debauched, and not allowed to enter. Lewd and debauched, although they don't use the word female, in the first Exclusion Act of 1875, the Page Act, lewd and debauched, you're talking about women. So banning Chinese women, the idea was that Chinese men would go home to have families, to marry, to be with Chinese women, and Chinese men would leave. What the Exclusion Act does, actually in the language, is prevent them from returning. So that's how it operated, and it endures 1882, 1892, 1902, but 1906, you have the San Francisco earthquake. And that sends everything up in smoke, including all of the immigration papers. So there's a huge group of Chinese people who come in because there's no immigration papers to say whether they were here before or not. So there's an enormous inward migration of Chinese people then in a very brief window until they build Angel Island Detention Center in the middle of San Francisco Bay to hold the Chinese until they can prove that they're here legally. So a lot of the tropes of anti-Chinese sentiment, which is really racist, and we see it now. We are in the years of anti-Asian hate right now. We saw it in the murder in the massage parlor in the South. We see it in the Chinese communities and Asian communities, where something like the reviews now are that 80% of Asian people feel that in some point or another, they faced insult, threats, disparaging remarks, their children marked out, their features marked out. This has endured. But when I looked at the photographs, and there are very few, but I found photographs of the police raiding an opium den. And we know that opium was one of the ways that Chinese people were targeted. Opium was not a Chinese tradition. It was imposed on China by the Brits, who needed something for China to buy. So Britain imposes opium that's grown in India on China. In the United States, when I looked at the police jotters and I looked at these photographs of opium dens, there are all of these pictures of white women in opium dens with Chinese salesmen, Chinese opium dealers, and the women are lying on these couches, white women, totally stoned out on opium. And, well, opium was legal. And if you look in the women's magazines of the time, it's sold as laudanum, a tincture of opium. This was the Valium, the feel-good pill of the time. And the newspapers didn't talk about the white women found in opium den. They were, opium was part with the gambling of seen as Chinese traditions. Everybody in the West were playing games. They were playing card games. They were gambling. One of the things that I discovered of what was gambled during the gold rush were African-American men, that they were gambled in card games in the West. So this was created as a Chinese phenomenon. It wasn't the reality. There were very few Chinese people in California that didn't account for the hoop-de-do. And as now, white people did not want the jobs that Chinese people were taking. The reason that Crocker and Leland Stanford of Stanford University, Crocker of Crocker Bank, signed contracts to bring in 10,000 Chinese men to finish the railroad is that white people didn't want that work.
You listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're discussing the historic institution of slavery in California with the author of a new book called California, a Slave State, Jean Falzer of the University of Delaware. I want to address this question of prison labor. You talk quite a bit about San Quentin, and, you know, of course, a lot of what you're describing is a fairly common thread, institutional thread about, you know, compelled labor, forced labor, slave labor, you know, whatever term you might use for that. And although there's a compelled labor component in San Quentin, I'd be remiss to not point out that there's at least one fundamental difference. And that is when you're talking about slave labor with indigenous populations or, you know, compelled or slave labor from Chinese women, et cetera, they certainly never signed up for it and were compelled to do this. Now, not that somebody who commits a crime signs up for compelled labor, but isn't the San Quentin population at least somewhat different in the fact that they are all, you know, convicted felons?
I think what we'd need to do, as I look back through the records of San Quentin Prison, and right now San Quentin is not making those records as easily available as they did before. So I'm going, you know, into biographies, autobiographies, diaries, letters to find the conditions of San Quentin Prison. But I think it would be a mistake to jump to the idea that we're talking about a criminal class of people who have broken the law and have lost their right to freedom. You know, we know that the 13th Amendment says it abolishes slavery except for committing a crime, except for punishment for a crime. But as I looked at the records that I could find of San Quentin Prison, these are really petty crimes. Somebody stealing food, somebody, you know, somebody shoplifting, taking food, stealing very, very little bits of money, and then committed to San Quentin Prison for decades at hard labor. So there was a problem of crime in San Francisco. It was a new, raw city. And we talked about the amount of money that was going east each year. But a lot of that money is staying in California, and it's around, and things were crazy expensive. A loaf of bread during the gold rush cost $12. So people had and needed money to survive. And I would be very careful about leaping to the idea of criminality and people being sent to penitentiary as a way of punishment for a really horrific crime or to protect the populace, the new populace of California, we would need to look very, very carefully at what people were imprisoned for. And to the degree I was able to do it, they hadn't done much. So I don't think that protecting the new population was the reason. They needed convict laborers to build the sewage system, to build the streets, and ultimately they needed convict laborers to build their own prison and wall themselves in.
Interesting. The last issue that I wanted to make sure to address is the question about the role between compelled labor, slave labor, and some of the practices with undocumented immigration. We know that frequently the discourses about immigration and undocumented immigration have to do with family unification, people fleeing violence, fleeing, you know, horrific living conditions, et cetera. But mixed into that are definitely narratives about slavery. Sometimes it's about sexual slavery, you know, sexual servitude, other times about manual labor, et cetera. And so ultimately, since California has this history of compelled labor, of slave labor, and we know that some of these practices continue, which usually the more vulnerable populations are people without documentation. And so it's more difficult for them to try to challenge the working conditions through the legal structure. What is the best way to address this question of slavery among undocumented immigrants?
I think there are huge and serious debates about undocumented people in the United States. And I wouldn't necessarily, in this particular question, pull out California from what's happening in the rest of the country. Right now, post the Obama years, we know that there are approximately 11 million undocumented workers living in the United States. And they've been living in the United States for a long time. There's also situations now where we have all faced it, whether we go into a restaurant, whether we're trying to shop for food, where there's supply chain issues. There are not enough working people who are willing to take entry-level jobs, which are typical jobs for immigrants. They're the jobs my dad took, my uncles took when they first came to the United States, factory work. Those jobs are going unfilled. And my view is that where are these 11 million people? Where are these the children of 11 million people? It's been several years since the Obama years and those numbers came out. These kids are growing up. They're going to school. They're entering the workforce. They're paying taxes. They're paying taxes, but they're too scared to actually use the social services that they're paying taxes on. So my personal view, and being the daughter of an immigrant family, is that we need these workers. These workers are already here. And the brutality at the detention center, the separation of families. We have FBI officials in Honduras trying to match up children with their lost parents. This is crazy. This is crazy global policy to rest it on the stereotypes of anti-immigrants, where in my view, we have 11 million people here. We have the need for entry-level workers. We're certainly making exceptions in the tech industry. If you're high tech, you can get a visa. If you're a physician, you can get a visa. If you're a nurse, you can get a visa. We're talking about entry-level labor here that our country needs and wants. And we know that Trump was handing out the H-3 visas, the visas for field labor, because he was under pressure by industrial agriculture. Two or three years ago, here in Northern California, the orchards of pears, the pears were rotting in the fields because there was no one to pick them, no one to can them, no one to ship them. This isn't a healthy solution given the right and wrong. And you obviously know where I stand on the right and wrong of this. But even for the economic needs of this country, for feed, for food and production and the health of this country, whether it's low-level healthcare workers, we need people and people are available. And yet there's this racist divide of who should be American and who should not. So we know that people are being seized from detention centers by human traffickers. We know people are being brought across the border, hidden in the trunks or even the wheel beds of trucks. We know that 90% of trafficked people are female. And so while there's this great theoretical divide between sex labor and between sex work and labor trafficking, these are the same people and they're vulnerable in the same way. And we now know that state after state is allowing child labor. They're allowing child labor because we need workers. This is vicious. And it isn't the tradition that I grew up with, where the age year by year by year, when I wanted a job, I was working for my dad, and it kept getting older and older and older to when I could legally work. So I think that we are creating a problem that's a racial problem and a white purity problem of who we think this country is that is not necessary, and it's really violent.
The title of the book is called California, a Slave State. The author is Jean Falzer. She is a professor of American Studies at the University of Delaware. And a reminder, her other books, one of which we talked about quite a bit, Driven Out, The Forgotten War Against Chinese Americans, Rebecca Harding Davis, Origins of Social Realism, and The Utopian Novel in America. Professor Falzer, thank you very, very much for joining us and sharing your thoughts on your work.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'd like to give a special thanks to the Scholar Circle team, Maria Armudian, host and anchor, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongri, webmaster and production assistant,
and Mahika Chechi is our intern.
On behalf of the Scholar Circle team, I am Doug Becker. Thank you for listening.